Hey everyone, this is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome back to the Device Talks weekly podcast. We have a jam-packed episode for you today. We've got some breaking news. Of course, on Thursday night, which is last night as I'm recording this, DaVinci announced it got FDA approval for DaVinci 5. So who did I call? Of course, I called Joe Mullings of the Mullings Group to sit down with him and talk about the impact of DaVinci 5. So Chris Newmarker and I connected with Joe Mullings on his own turf. We were visiting digitally over a Zoom call, of course, but Joe is in the 160 Studios studio, and the Dragonfly studio team was able to fit us into their very tight schedule and record some great insights from Joe as to what this means for DaVinci, what this means for other players in the surgical robotic system. So lots of great thoughts there. A little later in the podcast, we'll hear from our keynote guest. He is Murali Srivastava. He's the CEO of Acura Medical, and they are working on next-generation thrombectomy devices. I had a chance to visit with Acura with Kayleen Brown back in the fall, the day before Device Talks West. And just a special visit, I referenced that in the interview, but it's just great to be at a place where so much med tech is going on. So I really enjoyed reconnecting with Murali, hearing his story as to where he got or how he got where he is and how Acura sees the future of thrombectomy. So I'm sure you'll enjoy that conversation. A few notes. I wanted to remind you that we are talking surgical robotics next week on Device Talks Tuesdays. I'll give some more details in the middle of the episode, but we'll have presentations by Intuitive, by Medtronic, and by Virtual Incision. It's all free. You can ask questions during the presentations, and it's really going to be a great opportunity for you to hear directly from these leaders in the space. Go to devicetalks.com to register. And of course, make sure you register for Device Talks Boston, which is happening on May 1st and May 2nd at the Boston Convention Exhibition Center. Very excited to build off the DaVinci news. We actually have Brian Miller, who's Executive Vice President and Chief Digital Officer at Intuitive. And he'll be on hand to talk about the power of DaVinci 5. So we were able to get him on as a keynote, hoping that the FDA approval would come through, and it did. So I'm really fired up about that presentation. So make sure you don't miss that. You can go to boston.devicetalks.com to register for that. And, of course, devicetalks.com to register for next week's Surgical Robotics Device Talks Tuesdays. And, again, I'll give you a little more information about that later in the show. All right. With all that being said, let's get this episode going. All right. You ready for this?
Ready.
Marco, how are you, sir?
Doing well, Tom. Doing well. Good to talk to you from a beautiful Friday morning here in Minneapolis.
Yes, thank you for the weather report. This is the time when we'll normally talk about our least favorite sausages or our creepy Hummel figurines, but we don't have time for silliness today. No, we don't. There's too much news going on, and we're actually a visiting team. We're at the lovely 160 Studios virtually. Thank you to the 160 team for fitting us into their busy schedule for some late breaking news. We need a late breaking news flasher of some kind. So that's right. Buckwheat is dead. Remember that one? That was a classic. Anyway, that was a Saturday Night Live thing. But we're here with our host, Joe Mullings. Joe, welcome to your studio, our podcast.
Yeah. So, Tom, Chris, good to see you. And like you said earlier, special shout out to the Dragonfly team for getting this. You and I were on the phone last night, and right out to Nicole Ager and the team. So let's jump into the late breaking news.
Yes, right. Heading over
the wires last night, we had the news that Intuitive had won FDA clearance of their next-gen DaVinci 5 robot. We actually had a quick scoop like 2 months ago about them seeking FDA clearance for it, because I did something radical. I actually sat down and listened to the earnings call and was like, crazy idea.
Yeah, projection was going to be late April, and it came, you know, early. And let's Tom, I want to hear what you have to say, but let's just note this that the FDA got this out in March. So let's just put a pin in that and keep talking.
No, that's great. And we were anticipating it. We do have Brian Miller at EVP, the Chief Digital Officer at Device Talks Boston, precisely because we were anticipating the approval to come this spring. But there was part of me that was like, I hope this really happens. And the FDA did deliver. So we'll be talking a lot about surgical robotics at Device Talks Boston. We'll have Distal Motion. Yeah. We'll have Medtronic. We'll have Quantum. We'll have Stryker. I'm doing a keynote with CMR. And now, of course, the aforementioned Intuitive conversation. It's a big topic at Device Talks Boston. Next week, we also have our Surgical Robotics Virtual Week on Device Talks Tuesdays, which actually extends Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursdays. We'll have presentations by Intuitive and Medtronic and Virtual Incision, which I know is a favorite company of yours, Joe, as well. So we've got surgical robotics on the mind. And then when the news came out, Chris and I were kind of bantering back and forth of who can we get to talk about it. And of course, first and foremost, let's get Joe and Absolutely. See if he's available. So that stage being set, Chris, you're the professional journalist here. I'm just a studio guy.
Don't say that, Tom. Come on.
Take it away.
I mean, we had FDA clearance of the new robot, and this is like their next generation multi-port surgical robot. There'd been, a lot of, speculation over the last year or two when they would get a next generation robot out. And, along with, announcing the FDA clearance, they gave a nice summary of like all the different, improvements that they've packaged into the Da Vinci 5 versus, previous systems, including, they've got new. Well, actually, I'll start out with the thing that stuck out the most to me was that they said that the Da Vinci 5 has 10,000 times more computing power than the Da Vinci Z, the previous generation, which, I mean, they're saying this just isn't for, what the type of, programs they could run on it now, but they've, packaged in all this computing power so that for whatever developers figure out in the future that you could run on the system. So they've really, I mean, that kind of signals to me they've really built this thing to to be something that you could run a lot of innovative software on for potentially for years. So I mean that really stuck out to me. And then there's all kinds of I saw their packaging and features to a bunch of extra features to help with the workflow in the OR, very important for health providers right now with all the challenges they're going through with efficiency. The list goes on and on. New surgeon controllers with these vibration and tremor controls to have a smoother experience for the surgeon. Next gen, 3D display and image processing, this force feedback technology, to measure the forces being exerted on, tissue during surgery, and a whole new data stream to analyze because of this force feedback, technology. And they made the console more they say that the new console is more comfortable for the surgeons, which, if you're a surgeon doing all these procedures for the day, having a more comfortable console sounds like a good plan. So that's a nutshell. Yeah.
Sounds like a complete package. And I know one thing I've been seeing on social media, and I know the messaging has sort of been that this has been 10 years in the making. So Joe, we'll turn to you. This seems like, I feel like Joe Biden after Obamacare passed, like this is a big family show deal, what was your takeaway, Joe? What were you anticipating? What are your thoughts?
Well, look, I think, Chris, you pointed it out. Intuitive just released the chassis for probably the next 5 to 7 years. In the past, we could have said 10 years, but I just think the cycle of innovation occurring now is probably 5 to 7 on a chassis like this. So, and then the changing centers of care, and we'll jump into that in a minute too. So not surprising any of these features. Most of these were sort of baked into the conversations happening, but what's more important, you inferred, what else is under the skin, right? These features did not take, 10 years to reveal themselves. I think that this is another Intuitive of pulling people deeper into the pool. This is a time that Intuitive has done two things right now. They've created this technological moat around robotics that people think that, oh, it's a knockoff on Da Vinci Xi, or it's, well, you're not going to have a knockoff on Da Vinci 5 for a long time. So that's number one. Number two is Gary talked about, or Intuitive talked about, there's going to be a very, very limited release on this. So the reason they came out really fast on this is this is going to freeze any CapEx acquisition coming down range for any robot that's out there right now on that, on that larger format, higher acuity case robotic system. Because, and then you hear them use the word placements rather than sales. And these are all things you have to note, because if you're just looking at this as at a robot instead of a surgery as a service, robotic assisted surgery as a service is really what Intuitive is pushing here. So they've built the robotic moat around the business. They've just staked it earlier. It's going to freeze any, especially OUS, any high acuity surgical robotic platform. And then they're building the financial moat around the business where you don't have to buy the robot. You're going to lease it. We're going to partner with you. And then we're going to share the risk and the reward as you go ahead and no longer have to find 1.5 to 2 million to acquire something like this. And so now Gary's going to get, rather than putting, and he's got that war chest to be able to do this. And now he's just delivered to the surgeons a very meaningful platform. Again, very limited launch, but it's going to still freeze the market. I don't expect them really coming out in mass probably till even Q1 of 2025, but he did what he wanted to do. He froze the market. And now everything's going to be compared to, and this is where Intuitive gets that 20 years of inertia where they continue to move the goalpost. Every other surgical robotic, large format surgical robotic platform on these high acuity cases had to put a flag in the ground, and they had to put the flag on the ground trying to get close to Intuitive. And Intuitive just moved that flag, and everybody else is frozen in place there as they go ahead. Now they're locked into their pathway to the FDA. So go ahead, you, Tom, question.
There's a lot to unpack there, a lot of great stuff. Let's talk about freezing the market, first of all. Is the market frozen for a strategic that would have acquired a smaller surgical robotics company to complement their own surgical tools portfolio? Or is the market also frozen for larger companies that are developing their own systems? And maybe you could unpack a bit what frozen means. I mean, because these companies just aren't going to stop.
Yeah. Frozen means is, so let's look at Hugo as an example, and even Ottava as an example, right? Let's look at those two right now. Both J&J and Medtronic had to get into the robotic assisted business because they were having erosion to their current market because of Intuitive. And this is going to really hurt more, because now the feature set, the surgical end effectors, the tools, the ancillary, the devices that go with this, the digital capabilities, the data that the hospital and or outpatient surgery centers are going to now be able to get will far surpass what was in Ottava and Hugo, highly likely. So that's one. And now you're eating into an 80% gross margin on their analog endosurgery business. And now you're moving them even, Intuitive's pulling them deeper into the pool of razor thin margins if Hugo really does get market acceptance. If Ottava does get through the FDA in 2005, I might even say 2006. And so they had to freeze their systems against the standard of the Xi. Mm-hmm. And now Gary's just moved the goalpost way down range. And so you don't have that subject matter expertise in J&J or Medtronic. You're not a digital native. And now you're going to be comparing Hugo and Ottava to what they could only imagine Xi was in. So that's what I mean by moving the goalposts. Mm-hmm. And their designs and pathway to the FDA had to be frozen. I can guarantee you it didn't include any of these feature sets that now Da Vinci 5 has out.
I mean, have they basically just already won the game then?
No, the game's not over, right? We're playing an infinite game with robotic assisted surgery. But what I think you did is you now accelerated the lower acuity, not less complicated, but I think you just accelerated the value of the distal motions in the Moon surgicals, because they are going to be directed at that middle market, middle acuity, and to compete against Intuitive as a core against the high acuity cases is just, they're pulling you deeper into the pool on the financing moat, as well as the technological moat and the form factor moat. And so now, why pick a fight in that area, which is where Hugo, I believe, and Ottava are trying to pick it? Now you got to drop down to the middle acuity cases as an entry point. So I think this is good for surgical robotics overall. Mm-hmm. And it now will accelerate people saying, okay, form factor, acuity, that's where we have to fight. Now, if you think Intuitive doesn't have four solutions sitting on the sidelines for the middle acuity cases as a Gen 5 light, you're crazy. But I think that Intuitive is going to wait for 2 years, 3 years, until the ambulatory surgical centers declare what is that financial model look like, because there's no reason to fight there right now. And then as soon as Intuitive sees where that market's declaring itself, because it's still early, I think they're going to come out with a middle acuity platform that those surgeons are already accustomed to. But the first movers that will get through FDA or through FDA on that middle acuity in ASC will have a different fight on their hand. But by then, they'll have been acquired by highly likely Medtronic, J&J, or dare I say, Stryker. Mm-hmm. Because you're going to need the money to fight in that space. So I think Da Vinci 5 is a blessing for the lower acuity, mid to large format robots. That's where I'm holding my position right now.
Yeah, I certainly wouldn't want to suggest that a Medtronic or they're not small companies. They've got financial force. And I hear exactly what you're saying about Da Vinci 5 and the problems it creates. But I have to think that it's hard to envision. I mean, it's hard to meet for me to envision kind of a single standard of surgical robotic system being adopted across healthcare. There's going to have to be room for, yes, the distal motions and the moons, but also for other larger comprehensive surgical systems, do you think?
Yeah, but they're always going to be compared against the platinum standard. You can't make a robot cheaper than Da Vinci 5. It's not possible, right? You can't do that. Then when you think about the Chinese robots, you're going to have IP issues plus the geopolitical issues pulling those into the U.S. So I'm talking about the U.S. market right now.
We'll focus on that.
Right. Let's focus on the U.S. market. So let's look at the U.S. market at large. Any of these other large formats, CMR is going to come in. CMR, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, is right now, I think, in the FDA. CMR, solid robot. But again, the price is not going to be much different. And then you've got a war chest of billions of dollars that, you know, I think about Intuitive just starving people after they bring in all their troops, all their supplies, set up their camp and commit everything. And then Intuitive's going to go, oh, okay. And now I'm going to move it this way with my financial moat, or I'm going to move it with my technological moat. I would not want to be in a fight, and you're not going to accelerate 20 years of expertise in order to catch up to an Intuitive. So I'm not saying that large format, high acuity, robotic platform, form factor, and business model isn't up for grabs, but it's not up for grabs in the next decade.
Right. Wow. Fascinating. And the business model aspect, the financial, the robotic surgery as a subscription or a service sort of model, whatever you want to call it. That obviously opens the doors for other providers to be able to afford it, but it also changes the financial, and I think we've talked about this before, the financial parameters for Medtronic and J&J as they're moving into the space. They can't now budget, well, if we spend this, we'll make that, because that is suddenly a lot less clear than it was prior. Is that where we're sort of headed? It's going to sort of mystify the whole financial model of surgical robotics?
Well, it really impacts the startups, right? So if you look at the startup companies, so this is where the build to buy model and the venture companies and private equity companies that have constructed their sort of thesis around a build to buy model, this accelerates the build to buy model in surgical robotics. Why? Because the original thesis in surgical robotics, if you look at a Vicarious or you look at a CMR, was, was build a robot, sell a robot, put $1.5 million into the coffers. We can at least finance the company. But now, if the lease model is the current standard of business, that financing requires the company to have to carry that, the startup company, to have to carry that financial burden, where in the past, it was not built like that. So what does that mean? That means that the J&Js and the Medtronics and the Strikers, dare I say, will, on soft tissue robotics, will have the financial wherewithal. But their R&D budgets are smaller than ever. And so any acquisition generally comes off the R&D balance sheet. So if you're going to go out and buy a surgical robotic platform that's already generating revenue, you need a few things to happen. You need that surgical, that large format soft tissue surgical robotic platform to have the $1 billion required even before you're required, even before you're acquired. You need that in place. And then you need to develop a robot that at least is infringing upon where Intuitive's going, and convince people to buy that. And so that those two, that model will not exist in the large format up against Intuitive, but the build to buy will. So you will get the digital native surgical robotics startup company that will be financed by the off balance sheet of a J&J or a Medtronic or a Stryker. They will then share the clinical lift that's required through the large player. And then they'll be able to, the large player will then be able to construct their go-to-market team, their support team in that large format to be able to take that to market. So the acquisition price will be lower. The risk will be mitigated out. The robot that's being built will be built by robotic experts. And then the financial model no longer is a moat by Intuitive. But all those dynamics are going to have another 3 or 4 years ahead of them in large format, high acuity robotics. That's why I come back to some of these middle market acuity companies like Moon and Distal that are addressing the market in the ASC. And then Gary will come in, or, you know, Dave will come in, and they will introduce, unleash their hounds, their sales team, marketing team, data team, reputation into the ASC market. But by then, there'll probably be 2 or 3 acquisitions in that middle acuity surgical robotic platform, in my opinion.
It sounds like there's at least a few years window when those companies can get in and try to do something.
There's no rush for Intuitive to get into that right now. Right now, with the release of 5, and until you start to have some of these de novo ASCs being built out of the ground, where that's an entire market that Intuitive's not in right now, right? So you have to skate to where Intuitive is not in robotic-assisted surgery in their form factor, and that is exclusively the ASCs. If you're going to market as your primary market into the hospital setting, you're going to, without exception, you're going to get suffocated over time.
What about the surgical? I've got so many questions. First question. Intuitive kind of let this leak out in January that this was, it was something the analyst kind of picked up on rumors. This obviously had to be a project that's been going on for a long time. Was it widely known that there was a 5 coming out? I've talked to Intuitive people, interviewed. I've never said, "Hey, when's 5 coming out?" I should have asked that question, I suppose, although they probably wouldn't have answered. But is this something that you have seen being in the works for a long time, or has Intuitive sort of been really successful at keeping this on the down low?
I think at any point in time, Tom, that Intuitive has a number of programs going on, the same way that even Auris and Verb had their internal bake-off on their 2 robots to see, you know, what was best in class. And then they've been listening to the market really well. When you didn't have a threat in the market at all on a form factor, that as a large format form factor, you know, you're listening to the market. What are the docs been saying? Every SRS you went to that Vit Patel runs and his team is, you can give me an Intuitive robot, but I'll take 80% of what Intuitive could do, but give me a better visualization system and let me see what I can't see. So, you know, that has always been in development. You know, the weakness in any large format robot has always been the visualization system. until as of late, the workflow and the console, they haven't had to worry about that too much. I think you're seeing the current console release on 5 to be probably a precursor to an open cockpit that I think you're going to have to see in an ASC model. So it sort of is their hybrid move into it. Although surgeons still love the fidelity factor of having their head immersed in there probably reduce that console by 30% on the weight side, which is a big issue. And the form factor probably shrunk down a bit. So I think this has been going on. I think at any point in time, you've got a half a dozen legitimate programs going on with Intuitive that are answering what they're listening to through, what do they have? 14 million cases in all their portfolio. And they've got an installed base of 8,000, 8,500 robots. You're getting a lot of data back.
Yeah, it's hard to compete with that. Final question, because I know you get a full day. Chris, do you have one or?
No, keep on going, Tom. you're on a roll.
Where does this play, this is the kind of where this play out sort of question, but I had an interesting conversation with a LinkedIn post about BD and about their change in the leader of surgical. For those companies out there that have the surgical tools but don't yet have a surgical robotic system, what is this signal to them? Do they just, I mean, it seemed like, well, they might buy a CMR, or they might buy a system to kind of get into the game more quickly. If that freezing is happening, what happens with surgical device companies that don't have a robotic system yet? How do you see sort of that unfolding over the next couple of years? Do they just sit and wait? Or is this a starter pistol telling them that they have to act now? Well, how does that area of medtech unfold or unpack?
I think if you don't have a surgical robot today on a soft tissue side, soft tissue side,
yep,
and form factor. So let's talk about a large form factor on the soft tissue side. I think it accelerates if your Medtronic, J&J, Stryker, I'll even say BD. I'm really surprised Becton Dickinson on the soft tissue side is not getting yet. They might, but let's say J&J, Medtronic, and Stryker. I think you have to get into the surgical robotic world, but you've got to do it in a lower to mid acuity case. Hopefully their egos will not get in the way that they need to be operating at that elite and get into a fight, right? You don't bring a knife to a gunfight. And if you're going to get in a fight with Intuitive, they're all bringing a knife to a gunfight and you're just going to get destroyed. So I think this accelerates J&J, Medtronic, and Stryker of getting into that middle acuity case into the ASC world. This is so good for robotic-assisted surgery at large because it's now going to allow R&D dollars to be poured into something that will actually get to the market in soft tissue robotics. And there are a couple platforms out there right now that are primed to be able to be solid entrance into that model, Tom. So I think this is fabulous.
It's a great message that can be more competition from this. It's not competition.
No, it should set the stage for what you shouldn't fight in. And if you go ahead and go large format against them right now, your shareholders should probably come with torches and stakes. And so you need to be able to go into the market you can win in. So that's what I think it does. That's my takeaway on this one. I think it's fabulous for the market at large. And I think it's fabulous for, again, the middle acuity, large format, mid format robotic surgical platforms that are going into the areas that Da Vinci is not right now.
All right, great. Well, we clearly came to the right place for insights and understanding. So Joe Mullings, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
It's fantastic. Thanks so much.
Thanks, gentlemen. Have a good one. Hey, Chris, before we go, show me that Prince Cup again.
Yeah, doing some Minneapolis representing here.
Love it.
There you go. That's right.
See you guys.
Take care, everyone.
All right, see you. Take care.
All right, well, thanks again to Joe Mullings and the Dragonfly Studios team for fitting us in on a busy Friday morning. Next, I'd like to tell you about our Device Talks Tuesdays Surgical Robotics Week. This is the first time we're doing this. Typically, our Device Talks Tuesdays are on Tuesdays. Imagine that. Tuesday at 4 p.m. Eastern, we'd have our presentations brought to you by our sponsors. We're doing things a bit differently this time around. We're going to have presentations by major companies in the surgical robotic space. That includes Intuitive, that includes Medtronic, that includes Virtual Incision. So if you go to devicetalks.com and look under the Device Talks Tuesdays tab, there's a registration button. Click on that. You can see all of the details. We will have Catherine Rieger. She is Senior Director of Human Factors and User Research. She'll be talking about DaVinci overall, but a little bit about DaVinci 5, but really how Intuitive understands and recognizes that the surgeon, humans, remain the most important part of a surgical robotic system. So she'll be talking about interfaces and how Intuitive is viewing that. So that's on Tuesday, noon Eastern. And on the next day, Wednesday, March 20th at noon Eastern, I'll be speaking with Nikolai Begg. Nikolai Begg is Senior Director of Portfolio R&D. He is at the Robotic Surgical Technologies Group at Medtronic. And the title of Nikolai's talk is Insights to Innovation, the Future of Surgery. And Nikolai will be talking about the intersection of people and technology, what it means today, what it means for the future. So a really, really forward-looking discussion as to the future of technology and surgical robotics. And then on Thursday at noon Eastern, I'll be speaking with the team at Virtual Incision. I'll be talking to Shane Faritor, who's co-founder and chief technology officer, and Piet Hanul, who's the chief medical officer, Dr. Piet Hanul. And we're actually going to be taking a glimpse inside Virtual Incision's mock OR, and they're going to be showing off their mirror system. The mirror system is a version of the system, the space mirror system, that went to the ISS. So we've got three great conversations happening. Attendance to all three are free. You just need to register at devicetalks.com. If you watch live, we'll take questions. We'll answer. I'll get as many as I can answered for you. I'll be the moderator of all three. And if you can also watch on demand. You won't be able to ask the questions, but you'll still be able to enjoy every other aspect. You'll hear, you'll see presentations. You'll obviously watch the presenters. And it's almost as good as being live. But I recommend being live. It'd be nice to connect with you. The series is sponsored by several great partners of Device Talks, including New England Wire Technologies, Aptix, Viant, Maxon, Wind River, Omniseal Solutions, Tegra Medical, and Bay Cable Custom Interconnects. So thank you to all of our sponsors for making these three sessions possible and for making them free to you. So go to devicetalks.com to register and make sure you take part of this very informative 3 days of surgical robotics talk. All right, now let us get into our conversation with Murali Srivatsa. Again, he's the CEO of Akura Medical. Well, Murali Srivatsa, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom. Great to be here.
Great to visit again with Chief Ahmed. We actually had an in-person visit with you back in October before Device Talks
October West. October 17,
Yeah, that was a real treat. You gave us a nice show showing off your device and what it could do. And it was really, really an impressive visit. You know, Kayleen Brown and I were energized by that for a couple of months after. So thank you very much for your hospitality.
Absolutely. And, you know, I loved participating a couple of days later at the Device Talks West. Again, my first time at Device Talks West, I thought it was very well organized, great thought leaders on the program. And also fairly intimate, which is always a challenge in cardiovascular industry, right? I mean, the average conference has thousands, if not tens of thousands of people. To have a more intimate setting where you can ask questions, you can interact with the KOLs or the keynote speakers, I thought was really impressive. And I look forward to Device Talks West again.
Great. No, thank you for that. Yeah, we had 600 plus there, but we have a lot going on. So the rooms themselves certainly felt cozy and approachable. So I'm glad that registered with you. All right. Well, enough about me. People have come to hear about you. We'll talk about Akura in a few minutes, but first let's find out how you got there. What was your first entry into the medical device industry?
After about 10 years of working in various companies in the automotive and in the music sectors, I got my MBA in 1998 from IMD in Switzerland. There, I learned a lot about the medical technology industry. So one heard about the multi-link stent, which had just been launched, I believe, in the late 90s. and had made a rapid progress. One learned about Medtronic and Earl Barkin's invention of the pacemaker, Michel Murawski and the ICD. And when companies like Medtronic and Guidant came to campus, I was really intrigued by what they did and how they were able to transform the lives of both patients and those that treated those patients. And so I thought to myself, you know, I am interested in technology, but this way I can also have an impact on patients and do something useful to for society. And that's kind of my entry point into medtech. Guidant back then was coming on campus, and they had a really interesting system whereby they started you off in the field, especially those that did not have a prior medical technology background. They started you off in the field, taught you the business, and then moved you to marketing and to other roles. So that program really got my attention. So I joined Guidant in Philadelphia as a field clinical rep back in 1999. Wow. And then moved to St. Paul and further on. So that was my introduction and entry into the medical technology industry.
I'll lose my podcast license if I don't follow up. You do say you were in the music industry prior to this?
Yes. So I can say that I worked for CBS Records in India from 91 to 94. I can honestly say that people like Michael Jackson, Bruce Springsteen, Mariah Carey and others helped pay my salary, although they have no clue who I am. but they helped pay my salary back in those days.
Wow. So was that a career you would sort of just, were you interested in a career in music, or was it just a job that kind of led
more
to
from a,
another job?
You know, more commercialization perspective.
Yeah. Interesting. You know, all right. I've heard automotive before, but yours might be the first reference to the music industry. Was there anything particular about, I mean, people often have stories, personal stories that kind of drew them to being interested in medical technology. And the time when you joined in the late 90s, I think that was a particularly exciting time where a lot of things really started to come online. And it's when I joined, started covering the medtech industry as well. But was there anything in particular, on a personal note, that caught your heartstrings or caught your eye and drew you into medtech?
Yeah, absolutely. So my grandfather, he had a bypass surgery in the early 80s, and he passed away in 98. And one could see the impact of medicine on my grandfather in this case. And knowing that in 98, I was not an expert back then, but knowing that he might have had a much simpler surgery and same outcome with, say, the multi-link stent or other stents, kind of got me interested into looking more into this. We've had family members that had received pacemakers. Pacemakers were just entering the Indian market where a lot of my family was at that time. And you could see the impact that these devices were having on patients and in people that I know or closely related to me. And that made it even more compelling to be part of such an exciting industry that literally extends life and improves lives.
Interesting. So are you trained as an engineer?
Correct.
Okay.
Bachelor's in engineering. My early job, first job was in engineering, and then I moved to more techno-commercial kind of roles.
So joining Guidant, I'm always interested in collecting stories or anecdotes or just general feelings about the company. It's always looked back at positively. Anyone who is spent time there always seems to have walked away with a lot of lessons. What was your experience there?
I think they did a lot of things right. You know, the ability they invested in their people in what I believe is pretty unprecedented. They sent people like me with very little clinical experience into the field, trained them, helped you understand how the technology works, how it impacts patients, how to work in a hospital setting, understanding what the market needs are from a customer perspective. It's nice for somebody in marketing to imagine what the needs might be, but if you actually have firsthand experience supporting cases, I probably supported over 1,000 implants of ICDs and pacemakers during my time in the field. So you get personal experience knowing what matters and what does not. You know, one thing I say to my colleagues is 30 seconds in normal life versus 30 seconds in a surgery, right? They're two different, exact same units of time. The doctor's going to get pretty annoyed if you don't have an answer, you know, during a surgery and it takes you more than 30 seconds. So learning some of those things firsthand, I think, helps set the stage for personal growth and professional growth thereafter. So I really liked what Guidant did. I moved through marketing. And one of the other things that Guidant really did well was to allow you to work on new things. I was one of the early people to work on heart failure leads and delivery systems, which were, again, just entering the market, CRT and CRTD products. I was one of the early folks in upstream marketing working on them. Thereafter, I worked on the world's first wireless CRTD product and wireless home monitoring. So Guidant took a chance on you and allowed you to grow, maybe make a mistake or two along the way, but gave you a lot of responsibility and freedom, which is why it's not by accident that there are so many leaders in medtech today that all got their start at Guidant or worked with Guidant at some point in their career.
That's interesting. So looking at your background now, I see you were at Creventis in 2008, Vice President of Sales and Marketing, then President and CEO of, is it Kima?
Kima Medical?
Kima, yeah. Kima Medical in 2014. What's interesting, look at your LinkedIn. So you were with Guidant, which was acquired by Boston, Creventis, which was acquired by Medtronic, Kima, which would be acquired by Zoll. You've had some experience with M&A, the first one being probably one of the more notable ones in the industry. Any sort of lessons from... I mean, it's the nature of the business being acquired, building a technology and being acquired by a bigger company. So it's not an unusual track record. But I wonder, having gone through that process a few times, I wonder if you have any sort of takeaways from good or bad lessons that have been learned, experiences that maybe stand out of something that went particularly well. What are your feelings about the M&A process?
That's a great question. When we started at Corventus, initially it was started off as a heart failure company. And we were building a heart failure product. And then soon after I joined, we realized that a heart failure product, one, we have to get FDA approval and make sure that the product delivers on its promise. But there was no reimbursement pathway back then for heart failure monitoring. And so we had, as a small company, we had to develop the technology, get the FDA comfortable with the technology, then also work on reimbursement and all of the other aspects. So it occurred to me that, and this was also in 2008, 2009, when the whole market was not doing very well. So it occurred to me that this would probably be a very heavy lift and it'll take a long time. So one of the features in that product, and we were, I believe, the world's first patch-based arrhythmia monitor. So what I worked with the engineering team to say, hey, we are tracking ECGs. Can we make an ECG monitor out of this? And the engineering team delivered. We got FDA clearance for that product, the arrhythmia monitor. And then I set up the monitoring center in Philadelphia because Highmark was encouraging companies to help monitor patients with arrhythmias, especially if you can do it wirelessly and remotely. So we got Highmark to reimburse the product. And even though we started off as a heart failure company, our first product that was commercial was actually an arrhythmia monitor. Hmm. And we were using it to monitor patients, not just in the US, but internationally, with all of that data coming into our monitoring center in Philadelphia. That is just an example of how you might start somewhere. But if you realize the lift is too heavy, or, you know, it could be a regulatory challenge, it could be a technology challenge, you have to be nimble to make course adjustments so that you can continue to keep the faith of the investors and also have a timeline to profitability and things like that. And eventually, when Medtronic acquired that company, the first product that they launched was the arrhythmia monitor. And then, you know, heart failure came second because back then, even in 2014 and 15, there was no clear pathway to heart failure monitoring reimbursement.
I love that anecdote. And I'm just curious, how clear is the path forward when you're at that moment where you think a pivot is necessary? Is a direct step onto a clear path when you do that? Or is it very much a leap of faith? I'm sure once you're done and you've sold the company, you're like, oh, that was clearly the right thing to do. But at the time, you're probably feeling your way through the dark a little bit, or do you not move forward until you're absolutely sure that that's the right direction to go?
I think you have to have a leap of faith, right? You're not going to get every answer. And again, don't forget, this was 2009, right? All of the investments in, you know, venture capitalists were wary of investment. Now, of course, we were funded by Kleiner Perkins, and they believed in us, and they continued to fund us. But it was a challenge raising money. So we had to have a leap of faith. And back then, CardioNet had done some interesting work in reimbursement. So we had to project to our investors that we were doing something, yes, different, but less risky, because we are following the reimbursement pathway laid out by CardioNet. We were going to Florida. So you had some data points that you could rely on, but it was a leap of faith with, especially in those challenging times.
Interesting. And then you got to be, going back to my M&A thread, but you got to be president and CEO of Kama Medical Technologies. Was that something that you envisioned, that I want to be a startup CEO someday, or did the opportunity sort of present itself?
I think I started off as being president. I was the first employee in the U.S. It was an Israeli company.
Okay.
And they had come up with a very innovative technology. The lead investor was from the Bay Area, so he reached out to me, and we talked, and I joined them because he liked my Corventus background and also my prior background in the heart failure space. And again, this is a wearable monitor. It's a patch-based monitor. And now, I checked even this morning, it is available on the Zoll website as the Zoll heart failure system. So it is being marketed. So he thought that I could bring that kind of commercial lens to a technology developed from the Israeli defense forces, right? So this technology came from Rafael Defense Systems, the folks behind the Iron Dome and some of the other interesting technologies. So they used radar to monitor body parameters. So in our case, we used the radar technology to monitor lung fluid. So by putting it on the side of your body, you could actually monitor lung fluid, which again is a marker for patients with heart failure. So we developed that technology, made it useful in patients, and Zoll really liked that. This was acquired by the LifeVest division. Having another wearable, in this case a wearable defibrillator, they were wanting to get into the arrhythmia monitoring space and heart failure monitoring space. So they acquired us, and I was just seeing this morning that in the recent study at 90 days, this showed, I think, a 38% reduction in hospitalization, again, with an external monitor. And then I saw that as a first step. And then later on, if physicians believe that the patient would benefit, they can go in for a CardioMEMS or an Endotronix or one of the other implantable products. But as a first line of attack, you could probably try the wearable heart failure monitor.
Wow, so, that's great. Looking at the various M&A experiences you had, any sort of takeaways or common threads as to when it works well? It looks like they all had their own rationale behind it, which makes sense, but I don't know. Are there any commonalities or traits or takeaways from the experience?
I think a couple of them. We had near-death experiences at both startups. They were Fridays on which I was sitting either with the management or with the board wondering how to make payroll on Monday. So both things happened in both companies. So few lessons, be ready for near-death experiences, because we really had them with both companies. Hire experienced, versatile people, because your initial business plan may not end up being the final business plan. If you bring people with experience and versatility, you can pivot from product A to product B, whether it's technologists, reimbursement experts, regulatory experts, all of them. The more experience they have, I think the better. Be conserve cash to the extent you can. I mean, people may promise you, but when it comes time to give you, write you a check, it may or may not always happen. So conserve cash and always ask yourself, is the business model still relevant? And lastly, be ready to go downstream. You know, at Corventus, we went downstream. So we actually had paying customers at site. We had a few reps and we had paying customers in the US. We also had a B2B business. We were selling the arrhythmia monitors to a large pharma companies that were using it in their clinical trials. So be ready to bring in revenue in any way possible. If you had asked me in 2008, would I be working with a pharma company to bring in revenue for arrhythmia monitoring, I'd have said no way. But
that's great. And I want to get into Acura. We're here to talk about Acura Medical, but I don't want to leave out the fact you were Divisional Vice President of Global Heart Failure Marketing at Abbott. How did that come about, that position, and any quick takeaways for that little startup called Abbott? Kidding, of course.
No, I mean, Abbott was great. Abbott was a great experience. They approached me in 2017 to be part of the heart failure team here in Pleasanton. A few folks have told me the best experience you can get, and some recruiters have said the best talent that they like are people that have worked for one Guidant and two Abbott. So if you work with both, you're top talent. Anyway, I'll leave that there. But I think Abbott was at a very interesting time. They had bought St. Jude Medical, which in turn had bought Thoratec. So I was part of the heart failure division. We had three main products, the HeartMate 3 LVAD. We had CardioMEMS, and then we had the Centromac family of products for ECMO. And I thought that it was really great. When I joined Abbott, there were two players in the LVAD market, neck to neck. Abbott had also was working on the largest LVAD study, the Momentum 3 study. So getting that to its logical closure, working with the marketing team, building up a marketing team, growing the market, working on also growing share for Abbott. I think it offered a lot of interesting opportunities, and I really loved my time there. CardioMEMS was another high growth potential product. Working on the GUIDE heart failure study, seeing its publication in 2022, and seeing how the patient population expanded from with the FDA approval in 2022. Expanded from about 300,000 to 1.5 million. So I loved various aspects of working for Abbott in terms of, you know, helping grow the market, helping grow share, being very disciplined about, financials at the company. I've seen few companies being as disciplined about the business aspects of things as Abbott. So that again was a learning experience, which helps me here. And I hope I contributed there. I mean, when I was the head of global marketing, sales were in the 500 million. When I left, they were about 900 million plus. So I hope my team and I had a role in that. We also got some chairman's awards for best launch of the HeartMate 3 Momentum 3 study and things like that. So excellent experience to contribute and excellent learning from such an established player like Abbott.
That's great. So what was it about Acura Medical that convinced you to leave that? Did you have your mind on being a startup CEO again? And what was it about Acura's potential that lured you away?
Yeah, one had heard about Shifamed over the years and the successes they had. I had not met the founder of Shifamed, Amar Salahie, but I had heard of him. I've seen him in conferences and things like that. So this was a very interesting opportunity to build a company and to lead it from the early stages. They had just finished the Series A funding in January 22, and I was speaking with the leadership team here at Shifamed about this opportunity around that time. And it, again, got me very interested. My own father had deep vein thrombosis. Luckily, that resolved fairly quickly, about 2011 or so. And I have seen the devastation of pulmonary embolism among friends, family, and others. As it affects about 900,000 people in the U.S. is the third leading cause of death other than heart attack and stroke. So it is a serious issue and an opportunity to build a company from the ground up in the Bay Area and not just build one aspect, meaning the technology, but also building out the clinical, the regulatory, the manufacturing, all of that. And again, Tom, you saw it back in October. We have a vertically integrated line here. That was just an opportunity that promised to be a lot of fun and also an opportunity to do something in this space. I know there are other players in this space, but I think the penetration in this marketplace is still in the low teens or mid-teens. There's a huge opportunity in the U.S. And internationally, even today, the penetration of these devices is very, very low. So technology can drive adoption. Again, going back to my multi-link stent example, that paved the way for a lot of stents, you know, thereafter. And I feel that technology can make a huge difference, and that is what we're trying to do here at Akura. So this seemed like a great opportunity, and I jumped on it.
Talk a bit about the technology and how it sort of checked those boxes. I'm always fascinated by companies that are smaller companies that are developing new technology that obviously will differentiate itself from maybe existing products out there. But the fact that they're moving into a space where there already are some players, but they think they can do a better job, I think they can grab market share. Talk a bit about Akura's approach. Why is it different? And why do you think it's going to sort of check off that box that you're going to be able to increase adoption or encourage adoption by bringing this someday to market?
Yeah, I think the existing players have done a wonderful job educating the market. They've been growing, give or take, 25-30% every year, including 23. And I think they've done a great job in helping launch the field of mechanical thrombectomy and getting it to where it is. And there are, as with anything else, there are continued opportunities for improvement. And one is, how do you remove all types of clot in the venous system? So that is one, without having multiple catheter exchanges. How do you get the catheters delivered to the location of the clot and optimize that? And then how do you provide guidance to the physician through the procedure? So these were, we conducted some extensive market research in 2021 and 22. We spoke with physicians, practitioners using existing technologies and said, what are the technological gaps? And then we internally figured out how we could address them. So in terms of removing all types of clots, one of the things we have incorporated into our technology, we have aspiration, mechanical aspiration, and we also have fragmentation technology to break up the clot. So what that allows us to do is to go with a lower profile system to capture the clot, break it up, and then send it outside the body. So we have developed a single pass system. There is no need for multiple catheter exchanges. You go in, get close to the clot, aspirate it, fragment it, remove it, and be done. So this allows us to very effectively and hopefully quickly remove clot. Second thing is by having a flexible system, we have a steerable sheath. We have the ability to shoot contrast to help guide catheter delivery inside the body and make it get close to the clot. What it does is our sheath is a 16 French system with a 12 French catheter. So it's a lower profile system. We are able to access the clot quickly and optimize delivery of the system to the location of the clot as determined by the CT scan and as determined by injecting small amounts of contrast. The third thing is throughout the procedure, we have a console where you get measurements in terms of blood drawn, in terms of confirmation of clot engagement, and also pulmonary artery pressure readings. As you get to the pulmonary artery and once you're there, you get pressure readings from a pressure sensor that is integrated with our 16 French sheath. So with that, you are getting constant feedback on the pressures from the system And we believe that that would be useful in determining whether the clot has been captured and what the pressure changes once the clot has been removed. So again, more work has to be done. Our first job has been to provide the technology. Secondly, we now need to work on the regulatory pathway and then validate it clinically. But based on the first 5 patients that we have done in the Republic of Georgia last year, these are all useful tools. And the system is behaving in the manner that we designed it to provide a material benefit. But again, that will have to be validated from a regulatory and clinical perspective.
So I'm sorry if you're repeating yourself, but the current surgeons or physicians currently using this, what system or method do they use to sort of measure the success that they're having? It sounds as if yours has a more utilizes sensor technology to kind of give them a better sense of how things are going and clearing the clot. And how is that compared to what's currently available?
Right. So in our system, everything is integrated, so you don't need to use external products.
Okay.
So some physicians will use a pigtail pressure sensor. So they will use an other pressure sensor to get an idea of the pressure. Some, based on their experience, will know which clots to target. And once they remove the clot, they're able to determine based on the volume of clot. But as you can imagine, the volume of clot is not identical in different patients. So
sure.
You might remove 20 ml of clot from patient A and they'll be fine. And you might need to remove more in the next patient. And the clot morphology is also not the same, right? The consistency and morphology is different. So they do use judgment. They do use other pressure sensors today. And obviously, these are being done successfully today. We believe that we can enhance this whole process by integrating it within our system. So you don't have to use other products and you have the information available to you throughout the procedure.
What are the challenges that these surgeons are currently having that your system will help with? I imagine it's going to be simpler if they're not inserting multiple devices. Maybe there's fewer support staff in the room with them because they don't have as many things to monitor. Maybe it's just a faster procedure because it's kind of a single in and out. Maybe it's a combination of all of the three. What are the problems that you're solving or hope to be solving with this technology?
Right. I think first thing is it's an integrated system. So fewer exchanges. You go in, it's a single pass system. It's a sheath, custom sheath catheter combination. You go in with the same product and you finish the case and you exit. So fewer exchanges, fewer instances of lollipopping, which is when a clot is sticking, a large piece of clot is sticking to the distal end of the catheter, and then you have to remove the whole system and then go back in. So we don't have to do that. We can inject small amounts of contrast to determine the position of the catheter relative to the clot and precisely capture the clot, hopefully reducing blood loss in the process, because if you're not on top of the clot and you aspirate, you're going to pull blood out. But if you're on top of the clot, you will only pull out the clot. I think those are some of the things. We are a lower profile system, so it's a 16 French sheath with a 12 French catheter. In other words, that helps with navigating inside the body and accessing some of the more distal branches. And having information about blood loss and pressure readings and all of that, I hope will simplify decision making. So overall, again, to be validated, but overall we believe is that the case should be a little simpler, go faster. The extra information should make it also be usable by physicians at expert skill levels or less than expert skill levels, right? Because you can't always guarantee that every hospital will have the best staff and the most experienced physician at any given time. These are sometimes urgent cases. So this, I hope, will broaden the appeal of this whole field and allow greater access to this technology in the US, but also make it easier to be used internationally. And just as a proof point, when we did the first case, 5 cases in Georgia, in the Republic of Georgia, these were physicians that had never done mechanical thrombectomy before. We were able to train them, get them to understand the process, and successfully treat patients with results very similar to the results seen in the US studies. So our results were pretty compelling, given the fact that these were physicians that had never done mechanical thrombectomy earlier.
And I would guess that having one system that kind of collects all this information and data could also be upgraded at some point to put all that data to use in terms of measuring success or procedures and things like that. Do you look, is that incorporated in what you'd like to make commercial initially, or is that something you kind of look forward down the road, like eventually want this to be synced up with a digital surgery tool or even a robot or something like that? Do you kind of think that far ahead?
I think, you know, it offers possibilities in terms of potentially, you know, can you provide some guidance to physicians, yep, et cetera. The console, the way we have designed it today, it's a full-fledged computer also. It has the pumps and the motors and all of this, that equipment, but it also, yep, has a full-fledged computer that can be designed to communicate with the cloud. It can be designed to do other things,
okay,
beyond just supporting the procedure. So it may not be, all of this may not be available on day one, but you can think of all the innovation that could be possible once you have a system like this that has a full-fledged onboard computer that has communication and other capabilities.
A couple of questions just sort of as to the company itself. So you're in the mode where you're developing and perfecting the technology. You talked about regulatory, and we can maybe hit upon that next. But what are sort of the other silos within Acura that you're building at the same time you're trying to prove the device can do what you think it does? Are you just focusing on regulatory? Do you have an eye? Are you also starting to put a pot on for commercial? Like, in building this startup, is it sequential, or are you doing a lot of things simultaneous? How does that take shape?
We're doing a few things simultaneously, right? We are building our manufacturing capabilities. So we are now fully vertically integrated as of, you know, by the end of this quarter, we'll be making pretty much the whole product internally.
Okay. You know.
So that means the console and the disposable catheter sheets, etc., we are building completely in-house. So that was one. Number two is looking at the venous thromboembolism indication for the U.S. market to start with, and then looking at expanding those indications thereafter with the help of IDE and non-IDE studies. So that is something we are working on, expanding our clinical footprint. That is number two. And then also looking at expanding the regulatory footprint. So once we do all three, hopefully later in 24 and in 25, then the question comes about commercialization and how best to achieve it, right? And whether we start with a few centers of excellence for our product and then take it from there, or I think probably we'll end up doing something like that. We start with a limited number of centers and then expand accordingly, as we will also have to expand based on the new indications that we will be getting. So in order to get a pulmonary embolism indication in the U.S. market, one is expected to do, from based on what we can see from the others, about 100, 120 patient single-arm study, and to prove that the product does what the company believes it can do and treat pulmonary embolism patients successfully. So that is something that we'll be working on simultaneously. So it's not fully serial. A lot of things will happen simultaneously. And again, just to give you an example, a lot of parts we use right now are 3D printed parts. We will be transitioning to injection molded parts and next versions of the technology from an R&D perspective too.
That's exciting. Final question. Just I know folks hear the name Shifamed, and you referenced it a bit earlier, but can you just sort of give me a sense, or give our listeners a sense, as to how Acura Medical sort of fits into the broader Shifamed landscape? You're all kind of on the same family compound there, but I know you have relationships with the other portfolio companies. You certainly share walls in some cases, or parking lots at least, but where does Acura fit into Shifamed more broadly, and how does this ecosystem sort of work to create new startups?
Great question. I saw the birth of Laza, our most recent startup, in the end of 2023, where they raised their Series A round. And I think it's a wonderful ecosystem, and I love the collaboration among the companies. also the model whereby the shared resources take care of some of the critical functions like HR, intellectual property, finance. Some of those things are shared resources. And each company literally focuses on what it needs to do. So R&D, clinical, regulatory, operations, those areas. And I don't need to worry about following all of the HR laws because the shared resource team takes care of HR or finance and other laws. Just to give you an example, I won't mention the company, but one startup that I worked in earlier, during due diligence, we found out that we had forgotten to file our tax return.
Oopsie.
I mean, it's not a big deal. We had no revenues at that stage, so we filed it. But that will not happen here.
Yeah, that will not happen here. Yeah.
And just to give you a real concrete example, right? None of my team members had ever been to the Republic of Georgia, but our sister company had gone there. They had done some studies. They had worked with a CRO in the Republic of Georgia. So we leveraged our sister company's efforts in terms of insurance, CRO, all of those things. And we were able to get a running start. Otherwise, I don't even know where I would have started if I decided, okay, I want to go to Republic of Georgia. Where do I even start?
Right, right.
Whereas our sister company had done that work, so we were able to leverage that. So I can give you tons of such examples of how this ecosystem helps each other. I love the model.
It is a great model. As I said, we enjoyed our visit there. And I'm sure as you all find your successes, that institutional knowledge is going to get bigger and bigger and produce even better results. Well, this has been a great visit. I think a lot of lessons learned. And Murali, thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Absolutely. Delighted to be here and delighted to continue to work with you, Tom. Again, we are about 40 strong now at Akura, and we are continuing to grow. And I encourage your listeners to keep track of us on our website and on our LinkedIn channel and continue to track our progress.
Glad you brought that up. I spoke with an engineer yesterday who was asking about where to find opportunities. I said, go check out ShivaMed. Like, they've got a lot going on over there. So glad you fit that plug in. All right. Well, thanks, Murali. Great to see you again. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
All right, well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. Please do a few things. Please subscribe to the Device Talks Podcast Network so you don't miss a future episode of our great, 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 great podcasts. Please share this episode of Device Talks Weekly on social media. And when you do, connect with me, Tom Salemi, at Device Talks. Also, connect with Chris Newmarker. He is editor-in-chief of Mass Device. You can find us both on LinkedIn. And you know what? Even if you're not sharing this episode, well, shame on you, but connect with us anyway. We'd love to be part of your MedTech conversations going forward. Please give the Device Talks Podcast Network a ranking on iTunes or whatever podcast player you're using. I'm told those rankings are a great way to build our audience, and we would love to have the help. Thank you to everyone who's listening, but we want to get the word out to even more people. So give us a ranking. Finally, don't forget to register for next week's Surgical Robotics Week. It's part of Device Talks Tuesdays. You can do that at devicetalks.com. And of course, register for Device Talks Boston, which is happening on May 1st and 2nd at the Boston Convention and Exhibition Center. So please don't wait. There's a special offer coming. I'll have more details coming to you shortly about a special networking workshop that you will want to potentially be a part of. So go to devicetalks.com to register. That's it. Thanks again for listening in. Tune in next week. We'll have another episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast coming your way.